I think it's fair to say that for many of us, property developers are right up there with car salesmen and politicians when it comes to professions we least trust. Because by nature, isn't property development a dirty business? We see corruption watchdogs investigate dodgy deals about the rezoning of land or the approval of buildings that seem so out of place in our neighbourhoods. I'm sure you can think of an example or two as well. Someone with a fair bit of experience in the industry is Cameron Murray. Cameron's worked in property development, and these days he's an economist and researcher at the University of Queensland. Cameron's just completed a study looking into systemic favouritism in land rezoning in Queensland, which could in some ways be read as a sort of guide 101 for successful property development. Thanks very much for that, Cameron. It's very good of you.
Not a problem, Michael.
Tell me, when you were in property development, in what role were you in the industry?
One of my roles is assessing site acquisitions and looking at how much we could afford to pay for different sites. And to do that, what you would have to do is look at the scope for development within the plan and work backwards from your cost to get that highest use.
Right.
And that, what that kind of means is that if you can be favoured above someone else because you know you can actually develop something that's a little bit beyond the plan, then you are the one who's likely to win the bid because no one else will get those exemptions. And you can pay for more for the land, a touch more, and then also build something bigger and sell it for more and take another bit of profit off the top as well.
See, even the way you're talking about it, Cameron, at the outset says if you've got a vision and you can talk it up as being a vision, then that's all it really takes for you to maybe rise above the parapet.
Yeah, I mean, you can be advantaged by your connections from the get-go, prior to buying any piece of land, because you know in advance that you'll be treated well when it comes to getting your approvals.
Already I'm feeling dirty.
I understand.
So, Cameron, I take it you left the industry, but then were so fascinated by the process, you decided to actually attack it, at least the mechanisms thereof, with some kind of academic rigour. How did you do that?
Okay, so one of the problems you have in proving that there's favouritism in these rezoning decisions is finding a control group, because it may be the case that every landowner is well-connected, but only some of them are favoured. So it may not be, it just may be chance that we see these cases of well-connected landowners getting favours. So I had to find a control group of landowners who didn't get rezoned, that could have been rezoned, and look at their relationships as well and see if whether it was a characteristic of the relationships of the landowner or the land itself, which led to them missing out on this rezoning decision.
How fascinating. So you were finding people who wanted the advantages that some developers had but didn't actually end up getting. And so they were your control group. And then from there you did what?
So what I needed to do was find out who knows who. So I got all these landowners and I put them in a database. And then I needed to go and find out who they knew. So I got all the corporate records, all the corporate entities, and I found out who was on their board of directors and who used to be on their board of directors and who the major shareholders are. I looked at the industry group records for their memberships and their committee groups. I looked at the donations data from Queensland and Australia for the last 14 years.
So all this data is publicly available, Cameron. It's not like you were going behind the scenes and doing dirty deals yourself. This was all available in the public eye, was it?
It is available, but it's very hard to get. I mean, if you're a developer and you know you're going to get a sweet deal, you don't buy the block of land in your own name. You buy it in a trust, and you can seal some of these relationships. So what we had to do was get a big enough network that we could kind of track around these concealment efforts and find other relationships. So you might not track me because I own this land directly, but you might track me through some other relationships. So we end up with a much broader network using the publicly available data.
Okay, well, see, you're fulfilling every stereotype already in the way you're talking about this, Cameron. So I want to go back to base one because this is most intriguing, the land. Now, this is where it all starts. So this is the building block for development in every way I'm discussing here, whether it be physically or metaphysically. And so when it comes to selecting land, there's a knack here, isn't it? Because you want to buy the cheapest land you can to make as much money as you can on the development of land that may not even be rezoned for residential development or something else.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it's called land banking, and what you do is you basically buy land on the urban fringe that is currently not zoned for any urban development. It may just be agricultural zoning or some low-density zoning. You buy it at a price that reflects that use, and then what you do is you hold on to it and work your networks and hope that the politicians come through and announce that your block of land will be the next growth town centre and that you need your land rezoned for high density, you know, commuter suburb or whatever it might be. So you bought at an agricultural use.
Yes.
You get given a higher value use, and you can then immediately sell on those pieces of land to the next developer at a much higher value because they know they can build more density.
Ah, so without even developing it yourself, you've already realised a growth potential on the value of the land because of the rezoning.
Correct, and that happened in my data quite a lot. Some developers just literally play the land banking game, work their connections, get the rezoning and sell it to a smaller developer or sell parts of it to a smaller developer to decrease their exposure. So there's no obligation to follow through and build anything. You can just flog it off to the next guy and take your gains from your connections like that.
Now, you've been centering and focusing on the kind of behaviours going on in Queensland. What you're telling me here speaks directly to my experience having lived in Darwin in the Northern Territory as well, where some of the land that I'm thinking of that was turning to residential housing estate used to be mangrove and full of mosquitoes.
That happens all the time, and in my data there's an example at Caloundra where the local council had refused for 12 years the previous owners of this this land for urban development because it was low-lying, flood-prone, all these particular issues, and then one of the big developers up here, Stockland, bought the land and immediately it became part of the urban footprint. That's against the wishes of the local council because the state came in with their authority to override the local plans.
So this is where it's crucial. If people are taking notes on how to be a land developer here, write this down because, Cameron, you make the point that if you want to get this land banking a successful proposition, you've got to get a lobbyist at state government level.
Actually, you don't have to. If you're so well connected, you don't need a lobbyist.
Oh, really? So you don't have to buy one in if you've got the connections already?
Correct. And what happens, so there's a rule in Queensland that former politicians can't become lobbyists for 2 years after they leave Parliament, but what they can do is work directly for a development company. And so they can essentially become a full-time employee and lobby directly on behalf of the company. What they can't do is become a professional lobbyist who has many different clients for 2 years after leaving Parliament.
So if you're on a salary with a developer, that's different
correct.
To being a subcontractor as a lobbyist.
Correct.
Gotcha. Right. This is all fascinating to me. This is amazing.
So, the point being that there are some developers who are so well connected through employing the right people who have connections on their board and over time accumulating these relationships that they don't need to buy any particular person. Because they've built up these relationships over time, but the new guys, they're the ones that need to buy the services of a lobbyist. So the best way to think about this is the lobbyist has this monopoly on their relationships, and what you're doing when you buy their service, it's a bit like in the mafia, the lobbyist is vouching for the new guy. I'm putting my reputation, my relationships on the line for a fee for the new guy. I'm vouching for them that if you do them a favour, they'll join the club and do the right thing by you as well.
So they're your invitation into the inner sanctum for approval. So correct. I take it, therefore, if you're a land banker, someone who's taken a punt on a piece of land, got it rezoned, now you're selling it on, by definition, you could then move on to the next stage of the game, which is be a lobbyist because you've had experience in the industry.
You definitely can. That's that would happen. Typically, it works the other way, that the politicians become the lobbyists.
Right.
And you get it that way, because if you are good at... If you understand how to buy land and you would probably make more money just doing the same thing again.
Mm.
Buy some more land, get it rezoned, turn it over, keep going in that way.
So Cameron, we're running out of time, but we've kind of been traversing this and I've been slightly flippant about it, which is my want. But I guess what is at the heart of all this is, are these relationships inherently corrupt?
Well, corrupt in Queensland is a very, very narrowly defined. The best way to think about it is an ongoing exchange of favours. Now, you could say that the system is just, there's too much discretion for governments to simply rezone where they feel like it. There's not enough objective criteria or democratic input, you know, local elections and where we should expand.
This is where they run roughshod over the initial decision-making from local government.
That's right. So I don't know if I would call it strictly corrupt. I think I have more subtle definitions in mind. But
go on, I'm open to it. What is it?
You can definitely say the system, well, that's what I put in my title. It's a dirty system. If you start in a good position, you'll get favoured and you're favourable position will become entrenched over time.
So the system is actually set up, is it not, for this kind of push and pull, this influence, to end up being of a darker result? I mean, what I'm saying is that it may be within the letter of the law, but at the same time, it's influencing people's behaviour in a way that maybe will not necessarily benefit all of the community.
That's how I'd put it, yeah. It may strictly be within the bounds of the law, but it doesn't mean it's economically beneficial, and it definitely entrenches these advantaged people. And it comes at a cost. If you end up rezoning this commuter suburb, you may eventually end up having to, you know, expand the rail network, and all these costs, just because you wanted to favour this landowner in this location instead of somewhere else.
Well, Cameron, as flawed as it may be, and I'm taking a punt here and thinking that it's not just Queensland where this kind of relationship system operates to get things done and zoning to be rezoned. If that's the nature of the beast, how do we change the beast?
That's a good question, and that's where we end up at the end of the paper. Well, there are really two options. One is to remove the honeypot, to charge fees or change the rules so that if you are going to rezone land, you have to recover the value gain through betterment taxes or land taxes of some sort. So you essentially eliminate the potential to give favours by rezoning, because every time you rezone, the landowner has to pay if they want to develop to the higher use.
That sounds reasonable to me. And also, isn't there also sometimes a caveat on some developers that if you're going to go ahead with an estate or some kind of housing development, or it's been rezoned for that use, that you have to also build into it certain community amenities that go with it?
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, this does happen to a degree, but if you can imagine that the rezoning increases the value of a piece of land by, say, $10 million, and you make an additional set of obligations that are worth $2 million, you're still giving away $8 million. So what you have to do is make sure that those additional obligations, whether it's for public housing or open space or investment in infrastructure of some sort, have to be very close to the total amount of that gain. So that's about removing the honeypot. The other one is about removing the ability to exchange favours, and you'd be thinking here more about longer cooling off periods for politicians when they leave politics, and broadening the scope of what, you know, what they can and can't do. It's a little bit, you know, it's kind of laughable in a way that a politician who could be the infrastructure and planning minister can walk away on Friday afternoon from his office and then walk in Monday morning to his office at a big developer.
And yet it happens. You're saying it happens.
It's common. It doesn't just happen. It's just about every planning minister and or Lord Mayor. This same system happens at the local council level. Will walk out of their office and into a developer.
So if we had a five-year cooling off period where there was no association between former political portfolio and an area of interest in private industry, such as property, then that might also help create a buffer of independence.
That would definitely help, yep. I mean, there are a million ways to do this. The problem that we essentially conclude our report with this problem, the relationships that sustain these favours in property rezoning are the same ones that are going to impede any change to destroy this favour game, this exchange of favours. So,
yeah, yes, I take your point.
22.
It is indeed.
So look, my suggestion is just start voting for small political parties or the Greens. Just avoid the major parties for a while, and essentially change the group of people in power for a while. Make sure that happens regularly.
I do remember the old saying, though, absolute power corrupts absolutely, but I take your point. Cameron, it's been a fascinating conversation, and hopefully that'll get people thinking, listening at home or wherever they may be across the nation. Thanks so much indeed.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Cameron Murray, economist, researcher at the University of Queensland and former property developer, at least working for one, talking there about lifting the lid on how it all works. And everything I suspected, it seems to be true. If you've come up against this in some form or fashion, or perhaps if you're honest enough to talk about it, have done a bit of land banking in your past and have reaped the rewards through networking and the changing of land zoning, I'd love to hear from you. I dare you to actually Facebook me or text me. Or if you've been someone who you think has been a victim of this system, then again, feel free. 0418 226 576. That's my text line. And Facebook, you just look for RN Afternoons. Please don't mention company names or anything that may be legally sensitive, because if that's the case, I just can't read them out.